You are listening to the Makers Church podcast. For more information about our community, please visit makerschurch.org.
All right. No, stand back up. Stand back up. We're not done yet. Hold on. I gotta have a quick talk with you before you get all cut. Hey, look, if I'm standing, you're standing. It's going to be a long hour and a half, so get ready. I'm kidding. My name is Shalisa. I'm one of the pastors here, like Derek said, and we are in the middle of a series called All Good in the Hood, and today I am talking about singlehood, which I am really excited about. I have struggled with this idea of what singlehood is because according to a government document, if you're not married, you're single. But it's like, but what if I'm dating or what if I'm engaged? Like, I'm not single. You know, we just feel very rebellious about that. But for the sake of argument for today, we're going to say that singlehood is anybody who's not married. So if you are married, you can sit down. All right, single people, you're welcome. Take a look around, you know, out of the corner of your eye. You're just like, uh-huh. I mean, this isn't even a part of my talk, but I have to say, this is the most attractive, talented, God-fearing group of people. And if you're not dating each other, what is wrong with you? Get on it. All right, you guys can sit down too. So I actually have a pretty crazy dating history. At 5 years old, I fell in love. His name was Jared Trent. He was beautiful. And I was smitten until about the fifth grade. But then my mom in eighth grade took me to this conference called I Kiss Dating Goodbye. And I signed Halloween, I signed a purity pledge that said I would have my first kiss at the altar on my wedding day. I got my purity ring, and 3 months later, I broke my purity ring playing X-Men versus Street Fighter. So that should have been a really clear sign of troubles ahead of what was to come. I dated Brian Tarpey in high school for 2 weeks, which means we held hands once because I made him walking to history with Mr. Knox. But then I told my parents and they're like, are you going to marry him? I was like, I don't know, probably not. So I said, Brian, I'm sorry. I know you're in love with me, but we have to break up. He was devastated. I was fine. I moved on. Then when I was 21, I got my first boyfriend. He was my first kiss. We dated for 4 years. It went up in flames. And then I moved on to a series of other relationships where you kind of hope this one will be different. And then you do the same thing. You're like, okay, this one will be different. And none of those really worked out either. So I found myself at 27 years old, which in the Christian world of singleness is a grandma. You know, everyone's like, why aren't you married? And I'm like, because nobody's asked me. It's not the suitors are coming. And I'm like, no, thank you. No, thank you. So I realized, man, I really need some help. This is not an area I clearly am good at. And so I decided to go to counseling at 27. And counseling changed my life. It was a long series of, trial and error, and a lot of trial and a lot of error, and a lot of crushes and a lot of heartbreak and a lot more counseling. And finally, I got to the point where I was like, okay, I'm ready to start dating again. And maybe you've found yourself there where you're in a season where you're just like, man, the same thing keeps happening over and over. I gotta do something different. I gotta shake the Etch-A-Sketch. And so I did. I just decided that it was time to start dating again. And I'm actually getting married in 2 months. I don't know if you can see this tiny little ring on my finger that my fiance gave me. Yes, he is a very handsome man sitting in the front row here. And I know what you're thinking, great. So the way to be all good in the singlehood is to just get married. That's correct. No, that's not. Being all good in the singlehood isn't about finding a mate. It's about learning how to enjoy the wait, right? And I don't know if you're like me, but waiting is tough. We hate waiting. That's why we have microwaves and fast pass and 2-day shipping. Thank you, Amazon. You know, that's why we binge watch seasons of Netflix. Netflix is smart. They're not once a week. They're here's 4 seasons. Go. And you're like, yes, I must. Right? Because we hate waiting for those things. But the thing is if we're supposed to learn to enjoy the season of waiting, then we have to identify what is so challenging about waiting in the first place, right? Because waiting is not natural. If you love waiting, give me a woo. Yeah, exactly, right? Nobody in here is like, you know what? I really want that pizza. Maybe next week, right? Like, that's not how life is. That's why we have Postmates and DoorDash. You're like, I need it now. Actually, 45 minutes isn't quick enough. So waiting presents all sorts of challenges for us. So whether you're single and you're waiting for a spouse or just somebody to like text you back, you know, or you're waiting like for a job or you're waiting for test results or you're waiting for, you know, just clarity on something. Maybe you're waiting to have a family. I think there's a lot of really amazing truths that we can unpack in this idea around waiting that fits perfectly into how we learn to be all good in the singlehood. And so the first reason that waiting is super challenging is that waiting requires patience. And as is evidenced from your lack of woos, probably none of you are good at patience like I am. We actually have this like internal timer in our head that tells us how long something should take. And if it doesn't happen in that amount of time, that's where like anger comes from, like road rage, when you're like, why are you going 60 in the fast lane? Because in your mind, you're like, that's wrong, you know? Or you're waiting for your internet page to load. You're like, 10 seconds, what is that? That little spinning wheel of death. You're like, this is ridiculous. And you're ready to throw your MacBook. But I don't know if you guys remember like the time of dial-up. Like I had to go to the computer and like turn it on. It would take like 10 minutes to turn on. And then if somebody made a phone call and I had to like get off of AIM, I'm like, Mom, I'm trying to like talk to my crush, you know? And she's like, I'm talking to your Aunt Sandy. It'll be 4 hours. I'm like, Mom, why? But this is what happens. We become incredibly frustrated when the thing that we want doesn't happen when we want it. And there's so many like amazing scriptures that point to this idea that like God's ways are not our ways, right? His timing is not our timing. And even though it's a beautiful truth and it's hard to accept sometimes, you're like, God, get with the program. Let's go. Like, I'm ready. And that's how I felt when I started like dating. I'm like, okay, I have decided. I'm ready to go. Tomorrow would be great to meet my husband. But just so you know, that's not how it happened. There were a lot of dates that went wrong and there was a lot of time between when I decided I was ready and then when I met Drew. And in that process, one of the truths that I learned to realize is that like God's timing may not be in the like the speed or the way that we want, but his timing is always for our benefit. His timing is always for our benefit. And lots of amazing verses, but I remember in college, I read this verse in the book of Habakkuk. And some of you are like, the book of what? It's in the Old Testament towards the end. But the book of Habakkuk is this amazing story. And Habakkuk is having a conversation with God. And the land that he's living in, he and his people are under attack. They're in this war. And so the title of the chapter is Habakkuk's Complaints to God. And I thought, well, I can relate. I've got some complaints. Maybe you do. You're like, okay, God, when is this going to happen? Like, I've been waiting a long time. And so Habakkuk is making these complaints to God. And this is God's response to him. He says, look, be amazed. I'm doing something in your day that you would not believe even if I told you. And I remember reading that as a young woman and thinking, wow. Like the truth in that scripture is that God is working and he is doing something that I wouldn't even believe even if he had told me. And so Habakkuk does what the natural response is and goes, great, here's my second complaint, God. And so he starts complaining again to God. And he says the most common phrase that sticks out to me whenever I think of like King David in the Psalms and Habakkuk. And he says, how long? David said it all the time in Psalms. How long, O Lord, will you let my enemies triumph against me? How long must I wait? How long? How long? How long? And Habakkuk says, how long? Long. And this is God's response to Habakkuk in Habakkuk 2:3. He says, this vision is for a future time. It describes the end and it will be fulfilled. If it seems, Habakkuk, if it seems slow in coming, wait patiently, for it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. See, there's these things that we have a vision for. Maybe you have a vision for how your life would look at this age. To be honest, I didn't think I would be 34 before I got married. My life plan was like, I was gonna start dating at 18, be engaged at 21, married by 21, and then have kids by 25, and by now I should have had my 5 children and be done. But I haven't even started, right? But I had this vision for what my life would look like. And maybe you found yourself there where you're like, I have this vision. I feel like God has called me to be a mother, to be a boss, to have a family, to do these things, to pursue this career. But it's not happening. How long, God? Like, how long am I supposed to wait? And God says, wait patiently. The vision is for future time. It will come. It will not be delayed. But again, waiting is so hard because it requires patience. And if you were here 2 weeks ago when I gave the all good and the siblinghood talk, we talked about a guy named Jacob who was in conflict with his brother Esau. The part of the story that we actually skipped over is what happened when Jacob left Esau. And Jacob's story is incredible. He goes to see his uncle Laban in the camp of Canaan, and he sees the like hottest girl he's ever seen. And it's his cousin Rachel, which is a whole new conversation that I'm not gonna even get into today. Counseling is great if you're having those thoughts. But he sees his cousin Rachel and he's like, yes, her. So he goes to Laban, says, Laban, let me work for you for 7 years so that I can marry Rachel. I couldn't even barely wait 7 months. That's actually how long until we got engaged. But I'm like, 7 years? He's like, yeah, 7 years, I'll work for you. You give me Rachel. Laban says, deal. Good. I would have taken a cow, but sure, 7 years of labor. That sounds awesome. So Jacob does. He works for 7 years for this woman. Gets to the wedding day, marries her, goes in, does the marriage thing that you do on that night. Wakes up the next morning and realizes it's not Rachel, it's her older sister, Leah. Surprise, right? Like, but there were cultural customs that said the oldest has to get married first. So Jacob is not happy, and he goes to Laban, he's like, what happened? Like, I worked for 7 years for you, for Rachel, you gave me Leah. She has weak eyes, apparently, that's what scripture says. So, you know, she's bad vision. Like, I can't lead her around. I don't want to get contacts, you know? And so, and Laban's response is like, yeah, well, the oldest has to get married first. And Jacob's response is, all right, 7 more years, give me Rachel. And I was like, what? How in the world is Jacob's response to something he's been waiting for 7 years to say, I'll wait longer? See, because this story is incredible because Jacob had this why. He understood the cultural customs. He understood that even though he didn't like it, that's the way it had to be. And it wasn't his ideal timing, but he knew that at the end there would be Rachel. And so he waits and he waits. And one of the beautiful things that happens when we wait is we develop this amazing patience that brings perspective. There's something about waiting that really gives us a chance to see things from different angles and brings about this perspective. And I don't know if you've ever had to wait for something, but waiting usually brings a lot of clarity. When I was in 8th grade, I really, really, really wanted a piece of clothing that my parents wouldn't let me have. So I went to my grandma and I said, Mom, we need to go back to school shopping. And she's like, yes, let's go. And I went and I don't know how I saw these, but I wanted these knee-high, white, lace-up, heeled go-go boots because they were like the coolest thing ever. And I will never forget my dad saying no. And then my grandma said yes. And she bought them for me. And she got me like some corduroy skirts. I was looking real 60s. I had my like tucked-in shirt, my corduroy, my white knee-high go-go boots. I show up to 8th grade feeling real good until it came to recess. And I forgot I'm a tomboy. And I tried to go play basketball in my white knee-high lace-up go-go boots and my skirt. And it did not go very well. And I went home and I realized like that was probably not the smartest purchase. I should have bought Nikes instead. But I had this vision of like these go-go boots were the only thing I could think of. I was like, I want them. I have to have them. And you ever look back at pictures? I think Derek talked about it last week. Like you look back at pictures of yourself and you're like, who let me dress like that? What happened? This is your fault. But in that moment, like I wanted them so bad and I couldn't wait. And if I had probably like waited like 2 weeks, I probably wouldn't have wanted him anymore. And that's what patience does. Patience allows us to step back and reevaluate the relationship that we're in, to ask those hard questions. Do I want this? Do I need this? Patience allows us to reflect on what is happening in the process, and oftentimes will bring us a new perspective that is so critical when making wise choices. The second thing that waiting requires that I don't possess is self-control. I'm not a very super self-controlled person. But 1 Corinthians 7 speaks about the importance of self-control. Paul's talking to the church in Corinth, and he lays out some suggestions for them if you lack self-control. I won't make you raise your hand again if you do, but you know who you are. So 1 Corinthians 7, Paul says, "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." Agree to disagree, Paul. But Paul kind of sounds like that guy to me, like that can't get a girlfriend, so he says he doesn't want one. He's like, you know what? It's like, no, I don't even want that. You don't need to date. It's good. Like, I don't even like dating. It's dumb, so I'm just not going to do it. But as he says, hey, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Now that's something that I'm not learning in premarital counseling. Because if you read the scripture, it says don't deprive each other when you're married, unless you're devoting yourselves for a time to prayer, which I found fascinating. But then he says, but then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I thought, oh, interesting. Like that self-control is actually required in marriage. I always thought that once I got married, it would be easy. You know, all those things that you struggle with when you're single and you're like, once I get married, it'll be totally fine. It'll be so much easier. But the truth that Paul is saying is even when you're married, it requires self-control. Even in marriage, there are certain things that you have to learn how to wait for. And my recommendation, my warning to you is that if you can't do it when you're single, I doubt you'll be able to do it when you're married. If you're not able to exhibit self-control in singlehood, I don't think that you'll be able to do it when you're married. And that's why it's so important in these seasons of waiting to practice things like self-control. So he goes on, he says, "I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion." So Paul basically says, hey, if you're like me and you have self-control, don't do it. Don't get married. But if you burn with passion, then you should get married. And I love that. I'm like a burn with passion kind of girl. I am not like a self-controlled, yay. Like that's just not in my nature. And this whole part about him saying, if you can't abstain, if you can't live the life that you're called to live outside of marriage, then get married, because waiting requires self-control and most of us just aren't good at that. If you're not sure if you're good at self-control, you should just like put a box of like Girl Scout Thin Mint cookies in front of you. Or for me, like a box of Cheez-Its. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's easy to be like, yeah, I have self-control. I just didn't eat that tofu because, you know, I'm self-controlled. Like I'm really abstaining from celery. Like great. Like, yeah, most of us have self-control until there's something in front of us that we actually want. Right? It's easy to be like, oh yeah, I'm not sleeping around. It's because nobody's trying to sleep with you, right? Like, it's easy to have self-control until there's something in front of you that you actually want. And you know what I do when there's something in front of me that I really want? I just start making excuses. Our diet starts Monday, Cheez-Its. You know, like we start making all these excuses. And I don't know if you've ever heard this or said this to yourself. But here's some of the excuses that we make, like, but we love each other. Oh, that's so nice. I love Jared Trent, you know, but that didn't last. We love each other. Or like, we're going to get married anyway. Isn't that a nice excuse? Just do whatever you want. Yeah, but we're getting married anyways. Like, it's, what's the difference of 2 months? Like, it doesn't matter. Or like, isn't it better to just masturbate or watch porn than to sleep around? I know that one hurt. That hurt me because it's so easy to make these excuses where we justify, like, well, it's better than this, right? Like, I'll stop when I meet the right person. Like, I'm not hurting anyone. Because of our lack of self-control, we just make more and more excuses to justify our actions. But the thing that's even more challenging is that self-control isn't just about our actions. Self-control is about our minds. Scripture says we have to take captive every thought. And great, maybe you're not sleeping around, but do you constantly worry? Are you in anxiety and fear all the time over your future and what's going to happen? It's easy for us to say, oh, no, 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 no. Like, I won't engage in that sexual immorality. I'm good. And yet we sit here in anxiety and fear and worry, and we let our minds be completely controlled by truth that isn't from God. So it's not just about learning self-control of our bodies. It's about learning self-control of your minds, because our minds play tricks on us. Our minds run wild. Our minds let us create narratives and stories that don't exist. If you've ever waited for somebody to text you back, you're like, oh my gosh, they hate me. What's happening? They died. That must be why. It's like, no, he just doesn't like you. That's why he's not texting you. It's fine. If you've ever waited to get test results, medical results, an exam, anything, and you're feeling like, we create crazy, crazy narratives in our mind. You're waiting to get engaged and you're like, is it ever going to happen? Am I ever going to meet somebody? And so we start creating new stories and new truths. And that's why when scripture says take captive every thought and make it obedient to the truth of who Christ is. See, Habakkuk, he says, you have to wait. The thing, that vision that you have, it's not for now. It's for a future time. It's coming. It's not delaying. It will always be at the right time. It will always be in the right way. It just might not be in our way. So he says, you have to develop self-control. And what I love about self-control is self-control silences. Self-control silences fear. Self-control silences doubt. Self-control silences insecurity. When you have control of your mind and you hear something that doesn't align with who God says you are, with how you have viewed your life, and you are able to silence those things only when we control our minds. Self-control would have been really helpful when I was younger to silence all of my insecurities, right? To feel like, oh, well, I have to do this thing so that they'll love me. I have to like be this person so that they'll do this thing and then we can have a beautiful relationship. And if I had learned self-control of my heart, self-control of my mind, self-control of my actions, it would not only have given me perspective, but it probably would have calmed a lot of my fears. Because the third thing that waiting requires of us is vulnerability. I don't know about you, but I hate showing up first to like a restaurant or a date or anything. Like, I don't like being the first person to go somewhere because I'm always afraid that people are watching me, you know, and I'm sitting there awkwardly in the corner, like trying to like, do I pretend like I'm texting? Should I get a book out so I look really smart and like literate? And I'm like, oh, sorry, I was just reading some Tolstoy. I'm glad you're here for a coffee date. I don't like people watching me because I'm not in control of what they see. I want to control the perception that people have of me, but I love Brené Brown. If you've never read Brené Brown and you're interested in like vulnerability, she has an incredible book called Daring Greatly. And she says, vulnerability is about showing up and being seen. It's tough to do that when we're terrified about what people might see or think. I thought, man, yeah, like It's so hard to show up and be seen when we're scared of what people think. She has this other part in her book that really got to me. She talked about the fear that we have of like saying who we want to be or what we want to do. She's like, I don't understand why people are afraid to tell people that they're applying for a job out of fear that what others would think of if they didn't get it. And that hit so hard home for me because I am that person. I want to tell you after it already happened. Like, guess what? I applied for a job. Got it. Woo! Like, it's amazing. Or look, I lost 70 pounds. Nobody noticed. Like, it was so great. I did this diet and it all worked and it's amazing. Or like, hey, we're pregnant and we're 8 months along. Like, the fear. I thought about that. For all of our mothers who have ever experienced the pain that comes with a miscarriage and that joy and happiness you feel when you first become pregnant and you want to shout it out to the world, and yet there's this expectation that we wait. Because what if something happens? And Brené spoke so powerfully to this truth, and she said, but don't you want people in your corner if it doesn't work out? Why do we fear that people will judge us, that they'll think less of us, that they would view us differently if we're not able to accomplish the things that we have said that we want to do or the things that we've hoped for in the time or in the place or in the way that we want? And so what we do is we just don't tell anybody, right? You ever had something you wanted, but you just don't say it? I used to do that with getting married. I would always give the disclaimer. Well, if I get married, even though on the inside, I'm like, please God, please God, please God, please. I don't want to be Paul. Like, please let me get married. But I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't even know if I want it. Like, yeah. But no, it's like, I was so afraid to say that I wanted this thing, because what if it doesn't happen? Am I selfish to want something? Am I selfish to say, like, I want to be a mom? Because what if it doesn't happen? Or what if it doesn't happen in the way I thought it would happen? And what if people view me differently? And so we just take our darkness and we take all of that and we just hide in the corner. And we have these things that we're working on, these addictions that we're trying to conquer, or fears that we're trying to overcome. And instead of bringing people into the process, we retreat to a dark corner. But the thing about darkness is, darkness doesn't stay in our corners. Darkness loves to consume us. And so we hide one thing, and then the next thing you know, we hide another thing, and the next thing you know, well, we already hid those other two things, and so we can't bring this third thing to the light, because if we do, then the other two will come out. And so we just hide, and we hide, and we hide, and we say, you know what, once I am done, like, then I'll let people know. Once I've conquered that addiction, then I'll let people know. Like, then I'll let people in. Once I'm married and I'm past this, then, like, I'll let people in. Once I have the job or we have the family, like, then I'll let everyone know the process that I went through and I'll bring people in. But that's not actually, like, the life that God has called us to. In Ephesians 5, Paul's talking about darkness. And darkness could be anything for you. It could be a secret that you've just kept out of fear of what people would think of you. It could be actions. It can be your mind. It could be anything. But whatever your darkness is, he says, for at one time you were darkness. But now you are light in the Lord. He says, walk as children of light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. I don't know if you heard this. This is the fruit of light, the goodness of light is found in all that is good and right and true. Do you hear that? That light lives in truth, not in perception. There is no light to putting on your best face. There is no light in perception. Like, well, if people just look at me and see, you know, this perfect person that they're expecting me to be, like, it'll be good. He says, no, the light comes in the truth. And that hurts because, like, our perceptions can be so good and so untrue. He says, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. I love this, that vulnerability brings us vision. It says your greatest darkness, whatever it is, it becomes light when it's made visible. I'm gonna read this to you again. It says, anything that becomes visible is light. That means that God can take our darkest parts of ourselves, the worst parts of ourselves, our worst addictions, our worst fears, our worst actions, and he can make that light. He can use the darkest parts of us to actually bring light to this world. But here's the caveat. Only when it is exposed by the light. Only if it's brought into the light. But the light is terrifying because then everybody is going to know how messed up I am. Guess what? We're all messed up. We're all darkness. It says, you were all darkness, but now you are light. Not because of your goodness, but in Christ, you are light. Do you hear that? You're not light if you do the right things. He says, you're light because when you have me, even your darkest things, I can make light. Even your darkest, most painful truths of your life can bring hope and healing and light to someone else, but only if you have the vulnerability to put it out there. And there's a story in scripture that I come to time and time again when I think about like showing up and being seen. And it's the Pool of Bethesda. And the Pool of Bethesda in 8th century BC was this pool outside of the city walls in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate. It's kind of a dirty pool. And people would come into the city by this pool. And then in the first century, this pool was turned into an asclepion. Am I saying that right? Asclepion. Tough Greek words. Asclepion, which was a sacred healing temple to the god Asclepius, who is the god of medicine. And so this pool was turned into this temple to this god of medicine, this god of healing. And in John, it talks about how the angels would come down and they would stir the waters up in this pool. And whoever jumped in first was healed. Whoever could get into the pool first was healed. And so imagine all the sick, all the poor, all the lame, all the people who are suffering come to this pool in the hopes of being healed. But it's not so bad. Like, it's on the outside of the city. It's far away. It's removed. Until Jerusalem was rebuilt. And Herod, King Herod, decided that he wanted to move the walls of the city. And so he expands the walls and that pool of Bethesda that was once so far away and isolated where nobody could see you is now right in the middle of town. And so not only does he move the walls, but they built a road right by this pool. This place with so many people who are hurt and broken and sick and ashamed are now just being seen by everyone. And there's this man who's been waiting at this pool, says, for 38 years, waiting to be healed. Can you imagine waiting for something for 38 years? And he's waiting for 38 years to be healed. And in walks Jesus. On his way to a festival, on his way to a party, Jesus walks by this pool. And in John 5, it says, when Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, do you want to get well? It's my favorite question. Do you want to get married? Yeah. Do you want a family? Do you want a job? Do you want to be free from that addiction? Do you want help? And he says, do you want to get well? Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. He's like, I'm trying to get in, and when I'm trying to get in, someone else goes ahead of me. I've been waiting a long time for something and somebody else gets it. You're like, God, I've been waiting a really long time. Super glad that that 21-year-old has a boyfriend and they're getting married. Awesome. Good for them. Woo! Glad you got that promotion because I definitely didn't want it. Who wants more money and benefits? Not me. I'm good. He's waiting such a long time. And he says, God, like, I've tried to get better, but no one could help him. He says, no one will help me. And Bethesda is this word that actually means, thank you, actually means a house of grace and a house of mercy. So this place where all of the sick and the lame and the poor were coming to get grace and mercy. And he puts themselves out there and they say, here's my brokenness, here's my sickness, and no one is helping me. And maybe you felt that way before. Maybe with family, maybe with friends, maybe with the church. You finally got up the courage to show up and be seen. And you just felt like no one would help you. And what's super interesting about the Pool of Bethesda, 500 years later, the Asclepion, this temple of healing, they actually converted it into a church. And I read that and I thought, wow, yeah, of course, the place where all the broken can come and get healing, the place where all of the hurting can come and receive grace. And I did some research and I dug into this and I read this line that wrecked me because it said that Bethesda in both the Hebrew and the Aramaic is translated to mean house of grace and mercy, but it is also equally translated to mean house of shame. And I thought, the place that people come to get help, the place that we show up and we say, here's all of my brokenness, and we expect to get grace and mercy, and instead we find guilt and shame in the church. I thought, man, Jesus calls us the church. And I know that, like, I've been a victim of that, but I've also been guilty of that. That people come in with their brokenness and their pain, and we judge them and we shame them. And so they don't talk and they stay silent, and we don't talk about our brokenness and we don't talk about that thing. That's not what good Christians do. So we just shove it over into the darkness. But Jesus walks in on his way and he says, I'm here to heal you. Because with Jesus, there's no guilt and there's no shame. And Jesus doesn't look at our brokenness. Sorry. He doesn't look at you and see brokenness. He looks at you and he sees light. And he says, not my child, not my child. You are not meant to live in that darkness. You are not meant to live in that brokenness. And he's come that we can have healing. And Jesus looks at this man who's been paralyzed for 38 years. And he says, get up, pick up your mat and walk. And at once the man was cured and he picked up his mat and walked. And what he's saying to this man is, it doesn't matter how long you've been broken. 38 years is nothing to Jesus. It doesn't matter how long you've experienced this period of waiting. It doesn't matter how long you felt this guilt or this shame. He says, in my presence, there is none of that. In my presence, darkness cannot exist. He says, I brought you into the light to be light. Those things that you are longing for. He says, make them known, bring it in to the light. And like Habakkuk says, if it seems slow in coming, just wait patiently. For it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. So the end is coming. Healing is coming. The vision is coming. And if it's not coming as quickly as you like, then we have to learn how to wait. We have to learn how to develop patience. We have to learn how to grow self-control, not just of our actions, but of our minds. And we have to learn to be people who are vulnerable, who in our darkest moments, we show up and we let others see us. And we bring everything into the light so that what was once darkness can be called light.
You are listening to the Makers Church podcast. For more information about our community, please visit makerschurch.org.